Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show. It's Saturday, August 19th, 2006. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm with Executive Intelligence Review News Service with the economics staff. And today I will be the host for the hour-long show. As you know, it's weekly. And we are very pleased to be welcoming transatlantic guests today. That is, we have someone in Berlin and in Washington, D.C., two very important strategic places in the world for the directionality of world events today. Let's start in Berlin. We welcome with us Wolfgang Lilge, Dr. Lilge.
Yeah, good day. Hello.
And we will be getting back to him in just a minute, but Wolfgang is running for office to be a member of Parliament of Berlin. The election is September 17th, but he's running on the overall slate, which he will describe, and as part of an individual candidacy of the Civil Rights Solidarity Party there, associated, many of you know, with the LaRouche Youth Movement candidates, Daniel Buchmann for mayor of Berlin, and with Helga Zepp LaRouche, the leader of the World Schiller Institute, Lyndon LaRouche's wife. So I wanted to throw that out right now. As I say, we'll be returning to Wolfgang Lilge there in Berlin. But here in Washington, D.C., in the LaRouche Youth Movement office, we welcome Hector Rivas. Hi.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Good. Good to have you here today. And as I say, we'll be getting to you in just a moment because I have two very important urgent updates for people. You know, this show, you've seen we've been advertising in advance, is going to address the what you could call the economic, what you could call the why does deindustrialization or why does economic decay cause disease? So we're dealing with very fundamental aspects of the condition of physical economy. But really what we're involved in the LaRouche effort internationally is organizing on a deadline basis to try and vector the world away from the kind of disease, or that is to say warfare, chaos that we're seeing because of the decrease, the disintegration of the world financial system, the economic breakdown, and we are undertaking very specific actions to push the world towards restoring nation states, restoring the economy and the health condition of people. So it's from that point of view, let me just mention one particular urgent task for everyone. People will have been following the events in Lebanon and Israel in Southwest Asia and know that the United Nations Security Council voted a resolution about 10 days ago for there to be a ceasefire and all. But what this is a certain kind of opportunity, but what direction are things going to go in? So let me just give you this update. It was August 13th or thereabouts, where one of the architects of the original Oslo Accords in 1993 and prior to that the Madrid talks that began in 1991 about peace in this region, a gentleman named Yossi Bailon, who's a member of the Israeli cabinet and has held many positions, he put out a proposal that we should, on an emergency basis, have a Madrid 2, that is, call together the relevant nations and leaders of the region and internationally and have a round of talks for winning the peace in this fraught region, for having economic development. And this, I think he called it, he had an article called The Morning After Commission, after all this month of warfare. And his morning after solution was this kind of thing. It appeared in the Haaretz of August 13th. Mr. LaRouche then the same day endorsed this, and he has a statement of this endorsement. He said it's a bold move for peace, and we can't fool around and waste the opportunity. And this statement of endorsement is, I recommend everyone look at it and get it everywhere. It's available on Mr. LaRouche's Political Action Committee site. You'll know that's www.larouchepac.com, LaRouchePac.com. It's also on our publication site of Executive Intelligence Review. I'll give that throughout the show. But this endorsement by Mr. LaRouche of Yossi Bailon's proposal, the reason I want everyone to be familiar with it, but the we are urging you to get it around, because already around the world there is institutional attention to this, interest in this, and we don't have any time to lose. But to just indicate to people the what's going on, the major television channel in Russia, in fact, on August 16th, I think it's called First Channel TV, it's otherwise known as Vremya, they interviewed Mr. LaRouche here in the Washington area and had him on television on his concepts of who's behind this kind of World War III policy in the world that's causing trouble in Lebanon, Israel in particular. And there are other voices, too, that are, well, let's stay on Russia. There are other institutional moves there in this very strategic part of the world. A retired military person who's well-known there named General Colonel Leonid Ivashov also put out a statement during the week in which he used LaRouche's evaluation. He cited LaRouche's name, saying that you have to look behind who would be fomenting wars, and what do you see? You see the kind of world financial dictatorship that Mr. LaRouche has been talking about. And in other parts of the world, I'm going to mention something stateside here in the United States, there are other voices speaking out for restraint and for getting on a path towards winning the peace and stopping the warfare. And one example is a grouping of 22 retired military diplomats and others. A name a lot of people will know is General Hoare. They issued a statement this week calling on the government of the United States to hold back from any intention to escalate things and attack Iran. They said that must not be done. So there is movement in the world, but it's going to require that everyone get involved to hit Congress in the United States with it, do the kind of thing in Germany that Wolfgang Lilge can talk about, act anywhere you might be listening to us right now in the world, because it's the future of civilization is at stake. I don't think I have to motivate that. And one thing is the second point I just want to bring up for everyone's attention before we turn to our guests, is that a day and time has been set for a transatlantic webcast, an international interactive webcast by Mr. Lyndon LaRouche, and that's going to be September 6th, and the time of that based in Washington, D.C., will be 10 a.m., and in Berlin, I believe, Wolfgang, it's going to be 4 in the afternoon.
Yeah, that's right.
And this this event is pointing to the kind of world that we are involved in creating, even out of this midst of terrible threat. So its title of the event is something like the United States and Global Cooperation for Eurasian Development over the next 50 years. And this is, Mr. LaRouche has written a new paper. I'm just going to ask you to watch the websites for the next few days, because it literally has just been provided in the last 12 hours. It's called Dynamics and Economy, but it's like a prologue for this September 6th event. And the whole thematic here we're talking about is we have to restore the concept and the world of nation states and national sovereignty instead of this, what we're getting promoted from those who oppose nation states and have done so for decades. As you know, in the 20th century, these types of international financial syndicates called themselves and were called by U.S. intelligence the Syndicate International. But that is who's fomenting war. It isn't even the person who's now occupying the presidency in the United States, who seems to be going crazier every day, and as you see from his public speeches. But behind Dick Cheney, behind those who are saying we have to press ahead with more war in Iraq, expand the war in the Southwest Asia, you have this, as what LaRouche was quoted in Russia, this world financial dictatorship. So I recommend that people make plans to get the word out about the September 6th event. And that brings us around to why we're having our guests today. our LaRouche Youth Movement leader, Hector, in Washington, D.C., describing what we've been doing in August, what the mood of the country is. He's been in some of the hot zones, New York City and Washington, D.C., in the last 2 weeks. But we want to start in Berlin because, Wolfgang Luger, I said you're a candidate, but let me just start and ask you this, and then you can open things up in any way you like.
Mm-hmm.
But you, I know for months, you've been leading an education set of classes, an education drive that had this great name called Why Economic Decay Makes People Sick. So what are you up to there?
Yeah, thank you for being on the show. Yeah, it's we have a lot of fun in Berlin here. So we have a really large youth movement activity going on here, and we are in this campaign for the state elections here in Berlin. We are really turning the city upside down, and because it's absolutely urgent. So it's Berlin is in a state of decay. Especially economically, industrially, it has been deindustrialized like no other German place otherwise, probably. And we are confronted with a situation where things are really getting very, very well. Things have to be changed, and that's why I decided myself. Also to run for a seat in the city parliament, the state parliament of Berlin, to get the chance to turn things around, to direct the discussion to the really important things which have to be changed. Because when you look around, the discussion about healthcare system, the healthcare situation, which I'm dealing with very much, you never hear from so-called official politicians this connection, this direct connection between economic decay and decay of the healthcare system, which is completely a taboo, and that we have to break. And that's why we have the Büsow campaign, the campaign of the LaRouche movement in Berlin so much up front, to really break up the situation in Germany, to open up the discussion about real solutions, how to reindustrialize not only Berlin, but to create productive jobs all over the place in Germany. And from that start, the development of the Eurasian land bridge perspective, which we are campaigning for since actually the reunification of Germany.
Well, let me ask you, if you want to develop this more, I mean, it used to be made in Germany meant quality, right? And the great part of, and the German technological level and its huge amount of exports made a great difference to the world. So you're saying that the parameters of Berlin was a center of actual physical production, you're saying. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, could you tell people Berlin or Germany was also a center for very high-level healthcare? Is that what you're talking about here? That's been brought down.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly true. And Germany had a healthcare system which was envied by many nations in the world around, because it worked in situations where there's growth, there's industrial development, and there's technological development going on, because it is linked, the system is linked to the income of the population directly. So the amount of money which goes into the healthcare system is depending on the income and the income development of the population. And that was instituted already by the great statesman Bismarck in the 1880s, which really was a kind of coup at that situation, because in the last decades of the 19th century there was poverty, there was this industrial development going on, but poverty was prevailing because everything was a private imperial strategy behind. And Bismarck, in that situation, to prevent actually a revolutionary ferment going on against the nation, the developing nation of Germany, introduced these kind of reforms, introducing these Krankenkassen, these healthcare system, which provides actually kind of universal healthcare to the working population. It is designed in a way that it's a kind of solidarity principle behind. So the common good was very much and has been actually until very recently the basis for this actually very well functioning healthcare system in Germany. It has been expanded after the Bismarck time and so forth, and including a lot of benefits which are really available to the general population. You didn't have to pay extra money, extra fees, and so forth, and that stopped basically in terms of the further development and further positive the direction in the in the late 70s, in the 70s and the 80s especially, where the world economic crisis was hitting Germany very much, and we have since then in Germany especially a very, very high unemployment. So we have officially today in Germany there's around 5 million unemployed, but this is only the official figure. And our estimation is that Germany really has a real unemployment of up to 9 and 10 million people. So that is a crisis condition which cannot be which directly affects also the healthcare situation, because less and less money goes into the system because of living shrinking living standard and living income of the people.
So, right. So you're saying, in other words, for people to visualize this, is it the case after the Second World War or during Konrad Adenauer and so forth, there was an overall system based on hospitals, clinics, doctor, physicians, spas, and you mean there was an expectation of everyone having treatment, and then this has now not had the resources and has been cut back?
Yeah, that's exactly true. That is a case that the poverty in Germany is spreading so much that the resources available in the healthcare system itself are not sufficient anymore to cope with the situation, because as it is also known and very much in the forefront of knowledge of people, and when you are poor, you are getting sick. So this is a direct connection also where the paradoxical situation developing. So on the one side, you have less and less resources in the healthcare system available. On the other side, you have a much higher demand for treatment and for medical care for people who are getting sick under this decaying system. So that is actually the most clear indication for the necessity to create productive jobs again, so to restart the economy, to launch massive investment programs into infrastructure, into industry, to actually be able to not only reduce the rate of morbidity in the population, because when people really have an income again and can work and have a perspective, they are not sick so much. And on the other hand, increase the incoming money into the healthcare system to go back to the times where you could actually finance all these things.
I actually got a question for Wolfgang.
Go ahead, Hector.
Bringing up this question to actually build an animation in the listener's mind in terms of what actually are the dangers of certain diseases that we will combat in the future, mm-hmm. and our vulnerability because of the breakdown of the healthcare and breakdown of industry and so forth. Mm-hmm. Kind of digging into what happened, for example, in the 13th century Dark Age, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you can go over it, because as of now, you could say that people are sick, and it's happening at a much greater rate than it is now, but to kind of build a clear picture in some of the diseases that Eastern Europe and possibly even the United States can face, such as things like bird flu, which have been spreading,
mm-hmm.
the kind of diseases which are at the brink of breaking out unless there's some possible solution to this. If you can just go over that, animate to people what actually are the dangers that can spread throughout the world.
Right. the project which LaRouche launched already in the beginning of the 70s, the Biological Holocaust project, which was very much connected to the idea of how economic breakdown affects the health situation of the population. And in a non-linear, very dynamic way, creates conditions where you have disease spreading and the people getting more easy to catch an infection or to get sick in a very, very dynamic way. So we have worldwide a breakdown of healthcare institutions, of all healthcare systems everywhere. And that already in that study from the beginning of the 70s was indicating that not only old plagues, old diseases like tuberculosis, cholera, and so forth would break out in a much higher rate, but also new diseases would develop under these breakdown conditions. Because it's if you consider mankind as a living organism, then it's clear that when you are decreasing the living conditions, that these kind of circumstances for lower level life develops much easier. So we saw HIV coming up and HIV/AIDS coming up in the beginning of the 80s. And now we have we are confronted with this bird flu situation, which is really like only needs a little trigger where it could somehow ignite a bomb in a sense, which is also very poorly understood actually scientifically. We can only somehow guess that there may be some changes in the genome of a bird virus, which then could jump over to humans. This is much too mechanically viewed, the dynamic of how living processes interact with each other. Must be studied much more in depth, and probably also the bird flu situation would be a very good start for introducing these kind of new scientific ideas.
Let me ask along what Hector was saying and what you just said, Wolfgang. One thing is there's more prevalence, and that is more widespread, certain things, even if they're not exactly new. I understand that the H5N1, that is the specific bird flu, the virulent one, is just they just found in Spain in the last 2 weeks. That's not so surprising. It's other places. But you have something like that with what you say. It could transmute. It could. But since it's more widespread in general, you're vastly expanding the opportunity for who knows what to happen. But then we have old common things, like I understand measles in Britain made a big comeback, and certainly it killed or otherwise harmed and otherwise affected many people that it didn't have to. So these are very common things. Here in the Americas, we have tremendous advance of dengue fever, of the hemorrhagic form. But so this is the kind of thing that we're trying to visualize in our minds, that we're getting a proliferation of this. Is that the case?
Oh, yes, very much. This is, directly due to breakdown of healthcare system worldwide. And also, you talked about the measles situation in Great Britain. This is also a problem in East Germany and in Eastern Europe, also partly in Germany even, which is due to non-vaccination.
We had it here in Iowa in the last 3 months.
Yeah, right. So people are brainwashed in a sense also under the system that it's that it's not good for them to be vaccinated. It's a paradox. It's completely irrational. People think, or people are told, they would suffer from all kinds of effects, side effects from being vaccinated. But at the same time, was refusing to be vaccinated, they open up infection routes into the population, which could kill really thousands of people, millions of people. And they are very, I mean, there's a big whole list of these kind of diseases which have been basically wiped out in industrialized countries because of effective healthcare measures, and which then return now because it's simply either not paid anymore or on the other way I described, people are brainwashed into not using things which are actually available.
So this maybe, Wolfgang, gets into the idea that there was a temporary period, maybe 25 years or something, where the long wave continued of a certain amount of public health protection in certain parts of the world, not in Africa, you know, in parts of the Americas or parts of Asia. So people could think anything, any superstitious thing they liked, and they were still temporarily protected. But now it's all breaking down?
Yeah, it's like a wave, as you said. It's coming in a coordinated way with a wave of economic breakdown, which hits a population, which then responds in a sense also with disease, and the more in the same vein, the institutions in the healthcare system are demolished. Then you are losing also the ability to respond in an appropriate way. And another thing which I also want to stress again is the scientific approach to these kind of things. Because if you only react mechanistically to a certain health threat, you will never really solve it. And really have to understand again much more in depth what life really is all about, that we are not somehow dealing with an, if you look at an infection, we are not really dealing with an enemy which we really have to kill all the way to be protected against it. But the example of vaccination, for example, is a very good one, because you induce a process of immunization, which then the body itself can fight the disease. So you don't need antibiotics or these kind of direct weapons against bacteria to cure the disease. So this kind of rethinking of what the life process is all about, and how you can control it with with means which are not on the agenda now. So and we have to develop these kind of, well, with these new methods, new approaches. Otherwise, we will actually not have the ammunition to win this fight.
Right. Well, let me throw something in here, and then we can continue on the science, looking to the positive, to the advances we'd like to see in science, and ask you more about that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But I would like to throw in something that's been very useful, done by some researchers based in New York City earlier this year. They are public health experts. And in the American Association of Public Health, which has a journal, in March, was published an article on how the 1975 fiscal policies, they call it, imposed on the city of New York by what they call Big Mac, that was the Municipal Assistance Corporation, imposed on that city by Felix Rohatyn, that's who it was at the time, resulted in about 20 years of measurably increased disease rates, what they call an, quote, excess disease burden in the city of New York. And they studied in particular what you said, AIDS, HIV, which later became more understood. Mm-hmm. They studied tuberculosis. They studied homicide rates. It's what you're getting, part of social breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will tell everyone, Executive Intelligence Review has arranged to reprint this article by these people. It will be coming out in the August 25th issue. It will be available online in a few days, because they mentioned Felix Rohatyn by name, who is the one who they, and they quote Felix Rohatyn saying, we wanted private intrusion, that's his word, private intrusion in the pub, in the government of New York City, because it had to be that way, he said, for purposes of saving the credit rating, paying the city debt, that cuts had to be made in the number of hospitals in the city, in the vaccination programs, in the disease monitoring, in the drug rehabilitation, and these people go into it all. So I think that's a, it's a really a bombshell people can use in organizing in any part of the world. If someone says, oh, I know Felix Rohatyn or Lazard Frere or these international financial houses that are famous. This one goes back to the kind of syndicates in the 20s and 30s that literally backed fascist regimes in Europe. But anyway, when people say you can't blame these people for it's just they're part of the world, they're just bankers, they're not bad guys. This has, this ought to have tremendous value. And with that, I wanted to ask Hector, who was up in New York City, or you can start somewhere else, Hector, to describe, you were on the streets of New York making this point that cities, nation states, and populations are literally under threat of people like Felix Rohatyn, and you got a tremendous response. Is that right? Have we missed Hector there?
I'm sorry. I said yes. Yes. Actually.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was on mute.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. So, do you want to? When you were there with, were you there getting out? Who's behind, well, Mr. LaRouche's statement on who's behind World War III, or when were you there in New York City?
We actually entered right at that moment when he put out that release.
Uh-huh.
And right at that moment is when the UN was convening. And so we managed to get that out the night that it actually came out. We went in immediately the next day, which was on a Tuesday. And we distributed around 500 leaflets inside the UN to diplomats, some ambassadors, some military officials. You know, it was just a number of people that we talked to, but I think the important thing to get into here,
yes,
is what the intention was, because what it should be understood is that what we did in New York City is not different from what has to be done nationally and internationally.
Uh-huh.
And so we intended to look at this as part of the national deployment of the LaRouche Youth Movement. Obviously, to get done what has to be done in the United States. And so the first indication is in D.C. We have a huge responsibility to organize the institutions, given that they're here in Congress and so forth, where these people or these officials have the power to actually make the policy shifts which we are asking for and which we are endorsing, which has to be done. But the important thing is that the only thing that's going to move these institutions to make that type of quality change, qualitative,
yes,
change, excuse me, is through the people, right? The forgotten majority, the lower 80%, are the only people, as of now, that's going to have to take the responsibility and rise from the decadence that they've been forced to live in. They have to rise in order to push Washington to move in the direction that LaRouche and ourselves and what FDR did in the 30s has done and has to be done. And so we went into New York City with that intention, is that it's part of a national deployment. It's part of the expansion. It's part of the outreach that has to be conducted. And so our main idea is we needed to create a certain type of contact base that will be consistent in organizing and creating activity in New York City for us beyond what we have now, right?
Right.
And so we dove in, and we got the okay, and it was strategic, which obviously it's a big city. And so the first thing is we managed to get out over 400 pamphlets or so, actually. We thought it was 200, but it was more than that. And it was precisely against Rohatyn. It was Rohatyn and the Nazis pamphlet, which exposes his involvement with these Nazi institutions, Lazard Frere, André Meyer, and so forth, and his involvement in the breakdown of General Motors and Ford, being a consultant to the bankruptcy of Delphi in 2005 and so forth. And we pumped this literature out massively in Wall Street, the Rockefeller Center, and personally to one of Rohatyn's offices, which they didn't really enjoy. And so what has happened is we had to hit these institutions, and we also wanted to get a general, like I said, a base contact. And it did happen to a certain extent. What was unique about it is that we managed every single day to operate in some case against Rohatyn personally, with Wall Street on the first day, On day two, we went personally to his office, which freaked out people, came down, roughed us up a bit, in some cases shoved some of our members to the wall, called the cops, and you know, things of this sort got a little messy. And then the last day, we actually intervened in Congressman Rangel's birthday party. And it so happened that Rohan was actually personally in there. And this is a unique thing because I'll get back to the point. The point was is that there was this man, I think his name was Horowitz, who writes for the New York Observer, the Observer. And we were walking by, and we actually found a front-page article by this man, which had a picture of I guess, the current runner for governor, this guy Spitzer, and Roatan running into his brain with a suitcase. And so we checked it out, and we called up intelligence, and we called him back up, and he actually stated that he wanted to help us destroy Roatan. And the funny thing is, the way we found out that Roatan was at the tavern with Rangel that last Wednesday night was he came out and approached us while we were singing outside in front of the tavern, which they allowed us to. And he just told us bluntly that he was in there, and he was already in contact, and he knows already what we're doing. And so it was pretty strategic in that sense. And also at the same time, we had the Lebanon situation. Like I said before, the UN convened. And since we were there, it was good timing, perfect timing, that we got out the World War III statement, which we distributed all over the UN. We managed to stand outside for a couple of hours before we were kicked out because it's considered non-territory of the United States. And so, I mean, we were discussing policy with diplomats on the way out. And even if they try to turn away and ignore us, as soon as you stated, this is a message from Lyndon LaRouche and he wants you to know who is behind World War III, they would immediately turn around and take the leaflet and in many times walk and talk with us. And so this is the kind of impact we were able to make in New York City. And in the final day, what it was that we were really looking for was we actually met a young lady who owns who's part of a radio station up there. I can't remember exactly what it's called. And she became completely excited on LaRouche's policy and the ideas, and very excited of the fact that we were confident in knowing who the enemy was, which is the Synarchist International. And the thing that threw her up the most, or what got her more excited actually, was the fact that we want to organize people to get politically active with us. So it turned out to be more than just a plain interview. It turned out to be a base of how can I personally activate the people that I know to get involved with this type of activity. And so she's a contact that we've made who is willing to set up meetings for us and get some kind of base going on there, youth base. And so it was in a small scale, it was a mission complete. It was everything we were looking for. And now what's the only thing that's lacking is we need to be more consistent on it and see if we can expand in that area. But obviously the only way to do it is that there has to be a wider sense of recruitment nationally within all the locals in Los Angeles, here in D.C., Boston, Detroit, Seattle, Oakland, so forth. That's the point. If we are determined to organize the forgotten majority of the United States, because only then, and this is the significance of opening up New York City, only then, or actually then, that actually raises the potential and our power to transform the decisions that are made inside Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much. And people will recall that we had last week. People keep this in mind with what's going on in Mexico, of course, right now.
Yep.
That literally thousands and thousands. Ingrid Torres from Mexico City reported on the same kind of thing you're describing, Hector, of course, on a mass scale. So do you want to add, Wolfgang, in Berlin, you began by saying that this is the nature of what you're trying to do there in the actual election campaign in this sense.
Yes, I actually want to come back to this to the study about the New York City situation.
Oh, please do. Go ahead.
1975, because that is in a sense very much reminding me on the situation in Berlin today. Because it's also very funny because we gave out a campaign pamphlet, the recent one we produced, which has Rohatyn on the front page, and Mrs. Breuel and Mr. Sarrazin, who is the financial, the finance minister of Berlin, in a sense. And he's of the same type of massive austerity, cutting the budgets and doing everything to eliminate all productive things in the city. So the cutting of the budget austerity is going on in Berlin since at least 10-15 years. Actually, it started right after reunification. When the industrialization of Berlin really was the most and blatant. So what I actually also proposed during one of our latest campaign events on healthcare, the healthcare catastrophe, is that we make a study in Berlin itself about how the effects of these budget cuts affected the situation of the health situation of the population. So is it true, maybe, that we in Boston, Berlin have already this kind of death zones, which had been described in this study of EIR on Baltimore in the beginning of the year, where exactly the breakdown of economic infrastructure, economic productive activity, were causing these kind of premature deaths and complete crime rate and the destruction of the social structure in the city. So we are also sitting on a very explosive situation in Berlin, because there's a mixture of in the population where you can very fast get a ghettoization of foreigners, of all kinds of minorities in the city, which are really marginalized even more under the new laws, the social laws, which have now actually been recently pushed to parliament in Germany, which restrict even more the very low level of social welfare, which is being paid for long-term unemployed, for actually these millions of people who are on the poverty line. And that is actually actually a very exciting project to take up. And I think also the youth here in Berlin, also the LaRouche youth movement, people in Berlin, were very interested in this kind of project. Also the animation aspect, which was mentioned already before.
Right, it was mentioned that, and the LaRouche youth movement here in the United States, Mr. LaRouche has talked directly about animating the New York City historical Big Mac situation, which is itself the two things: the indictment of Felix Rohatyn, who did it, and it also then engages people to think about how a real economy works or doesn't work, right? Instead of these illusions and these non-think and these delusions. I'll throw in that on the last year would have been the 30th anniversary of the Big Mac, Felix Rohatyn's austerity push in New York City. And do you know, when he was interviewed last year by a New York City newspaper, he said, "This was the best years of my career so far. It was so exciting. It was so dramatic. We fought opposition." By that, he means fought the firefighters, the physician, the head of the health commission of the city of New York resigned. So anyway, that's what that's about. Hector, do you have more comments or questions about Germany itself or Washington, D.C.?
Well, I actually do. I want to see if I can get a picture of, because I know a breakdown in sanitation.
Yes.
Can greatly contribute to creation of new diseases or emergence of diseases that we've actually, you know, wiped out to a certain extent before. One thing is, if I can get a history of that in Berlin, and for the listeners as well, but it just should be noted that in our trip in New York City, one thing that really was very interesting is that when you walk up some of the streets, you would find piles of garbage just lying there, which I wouldn't believe is very normal at all. And I was wondering if the same type of problem exists in Berlin or in Germany or in Europe in general, and in terms of what was the sanitation capabilities before and what it actually has broken down into. If I can get a word on that, the kind of pesticides that have actually, I guess, reemerged in Berlin, certain type of rodents have gotten rid of, if I can get a word on that.
Yeah, it's going very much in that direction. It's probably not yet that worse or that bad as in the United States in certain places. So it's there are still, I mean, the sanitation infrastructure still works to a certain degree. But we should remember that all these things have to be maintained, and there must be continuous investments, especially into sanitation of water systems and so forth, which are very, very old in Berlin. I mean, Berlin was planned as a city in the 1800s, and the expansion was very, very directed and planned. So all these systems have been developed. They are more than 100 years old, partly. And if you simply neglect and investing in these things and maintain them, then they will break down at a certain point. That is starting very much from right now. So you have news every week or whatever that a main water pipe broke up, or there's another infrastructure breakdown going on. There's everything which goes in that direction. There's a potential which is developing, and that's the same somehow moving on a breaking point. So when that is crossed, then actually these things will also be visibly the same, visibly there, exactly in the same way as it's probably more advanced in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, Wolfgang, running in for a candidate as a member of the parliament, mm-hmm. what is it exactly that you can do, or what's actually, I guess, anything that's put on the table already as a proposal for the reversal of the decay of healthcare?
Well, I personally decided to run in a district in Berlin where one of the large university clinics are located. And that is probably a kind of paradigm of how the health infrastructure and health situation in Berlin is breaking down right now, because most of these clinics, all of these university clinics, they are not private. I mean, this is still state-run or subsidized by federal money and then so forth. But there was the process going on after East Berlin and West Berlin grew together again after reunification, that there was suddenly the city government for all of Berlin was confronted with the situation that there were three functioning university clinics, two in West Berlin and in the Charité in East Berlin. And there was very less and less money available for running these clinics, so they had to proposal to to close down one of them completely, and then fuse the rest of the two together, which was rejected. There was a lot of protest against these things, against these plans. So finally, they came up with a plan to make a fusion of all three Berlin University clinics, but not with the idea of creating something large, which is functioning, which is more effective in the healthcare system, but with a mandate to cut costs. So, and then you can imagine what happened in the last couple of years, where the mandate was to eliminate all so-called superfluous capacities, so which are double or triple or whatever. So there's a kind of infight going on in the healthcare and in these university clinics, which is incredible. And there's no control of these things anymore. So there's a lot of only financial pressure going on. So the subsidies from the city is going away. And then in addition, we have we had a reform of the financial system in the clinics themselves, where they went back to, or they introduced these what's this called? It's Fallpauschale. It's called where you get the money for the clinics is paid by diagnosis. So you have a diagnosis and you get a certain amount of money regardless how long this patient is in the clinic. So this makes a lot of pressure.
You're saying the clinic is paid by a diagnosis?
Oh. Yeah, the system is called diagnosis-related groups, which has been, I think, was also introduced in the United States already.
Yes, exactly. It's a way to underpay hospitals and physicians. It's a sneaky way pay what someone, if someone really needs to be in the hospital for 2 weeks, they should get that. Instead, they just pay for a set standard amount, not connected to the genuine case. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So that we had before in Germany, we had a system where every hospital received the money according to its facilities and possibilities, which was a rate for every patient per day in the clinic, a kind of general sum. And that has been eliminated because actually that worked very well because clinics could plan much better. And also the physicians were free to actually decide this patient has to stay in the hospital for a couple of days more or less or so, but that was always the decision of the physician, of the doctors. Now the decision to stay in hospital, how long you stay in hospital, is taken by the economists. So it's like these Raton types. So it's not the decision of the doctor to leave a patient in the clinic for much longer because they don't get money, they get bankrupt. And that's just one more element now in the financial constraint which the clinics in Berlin or actually all over Germany are in. So which of course brings up privatization of clinics. So all these private hospital chains, they are taking over smaller clinics, and also in Germany, in two actually university clinics have been privatized. So that's going very much in to be the American condition in Germany. So it's very very fast how you see how these healthcare infrastructure, which was functioning very well actually still 20 years ago, is now going to decay, especially in Berlin, where things are really coming to a point.
Earlier you mentioned this this thing about, I guess, three universal clinics or university clinics merging together or fusing together. Can you explain that again?
Yeah, they have been now fused into one large university clinic, which is called now the Charité, and which includes all of these three parts still existing in Berlin, which has strange consequences, because at some clinics you have special operations going on, surgery going on. So a patient is transported from one place in Berlin to the special clinic where the university clinic where the surgery is taking place, and then brought back. So it's a pain. It's simply just inhuman what is going on there, you know. They are trying to cut away and close down all parts of clinics altogether. They're eliminating especially so-called expensive things, which are somehow on the chopping block. Actually, the latest example, which is really also causing an uproar in Berlin, is a plan to close a radiation laboratory, which is a very specific treatment facility for tumors in the eye, which is radiated with a specific proton source, which is very unique. It only exists in Berlin. There's one facility in Switzerland and one facility, I think, in the United States. So, and because only, I think it's only 7 million euros per year, which is missing in the budget of this facility, they just want to close it down altogether. which is really a scandal for, I mean, Berlin still has a kind of fame for being known as a medical technology, a city of medical technology, a center for medical research and these kind of things. And if this is allowed to take place, to shut down this kind of really highly specialized, high technology facility, this will also be, calling for the fate of Berlin itself.
Is this the? Do you have a couple of these laboratories? Is this the only radiation laboratory that exists in Berlin? Or
in that specific form, this specific treatment which they are doing exists only in Germany, and in Berlin only for all Germany and all of Europe apart from Switzerland, as I said. So it's a very specialized radiation source.
And one question, Wolfgang, because you were talking, too, about how we should go ahead with certain lines of science. There are things, if you have, speaking of creativity, if you have technicians that are around very high-tech things, like dealing with fussy, refined things of the eye, it could be they can give thought to other processes that are less known. You've had the famous case, Hector asked about world diseases, coming about. Look at what's called mad cow disease. It's called bovine spongiform encephalopathy, but it's part of what they call transmissible nerve diseases. Mm-hmm. And is this a kind of thing where radiation and investigation is is the one area you'd really want to pursue, would you not?
Yes, this is exactly one pathway of science which points to the future, because radiation in that sense is a very specific, also coherent idea behind. And the same thing is behind laser treatment, which is also, Berlin is a kind of center for that. So there's actually one clinic which specializes only on laser surgery. But there are also other facilities in Berlin which is still alive. There's a lot of experiments with laser technologies, coherent radiation to stimulate living processes which are not otherwise either made visible, or you cannot stimulate certain processes in another way. So Berlin still has a large potential. I really have to stress it, because this is also the basis of our approach. Berlin still has a tremendous potential for making contributions in this worldwide fight against disease. And we really cannot allow that any of these facilities are shut down because of a couple of million dollars or euros per year that this potential is lost.
You mentioned this about, I think it's related to the radiation laboratory, in terms of stimulating living processes. What, can you get into that a little more?
Well, it's very, very obvious that living processes are highly coordinated. So if you imagine a cell, a living cell, which is a chemical factory of proportions which you cannot imagine, really. There are millions of chemical processes going on every millisecond or every second, which is unmatched by any technical device. So there must be. And then that is, I think, the precondition for that you actually can imagine how life works, that this is coordinated and regulated by highly coordinated, highly regular processes in the whatever electromagnetic spectrum, from very low frequencies to very high frequencies and whatever's in the middle. So laser technology and radiation technology is probably the best way of which you can use to understand these living processes going on in organisms or in one single cell, which somehow goes back to also what Russian researchers at the beginning of the century around Gorvitch found out. That, for example, electromagnetic radiation, ultraviolet light, is very much involved in coordinating the division of cells, for example.
Now, I have to, Wolfgang, it's hard to believe. We've come to the end of the hour, thanks to Hector Rivas and Wolfgang Lilge in Berlin. And I just to wrap up, this does, I think, summarize what kind of thing is involved in looking forward to 50 years of development and economic development in science instead of this warmongering by the dying system. And so I have to thank you today. It's been the LaRouche Show. We are weekly from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. This has been August 19th, 2006. And please, again, next week on August 26 will be Harley Schlanger, and this is the close of the LaRouche Show. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Thank you very much.
Thank you.